funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We've all heard that clothes can make the man, but have you considered how clothes might make the movie? You might not recognize Deborah Nadulman Landis walking down the street, but the characters she has dressed have turned out to be some of the most iconic images in modern cinematic history. She put the red leather jacket on Michael Jackson in Thriller, crowned John Belushi's Animal House toga with those laurel leaves, put the suits and the shades on the Blues Brothers, and the fedora on Indiana Jones. This summer, she was named David C. Copley Chair for the Study of Costume Design at UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television. She's also written a book called Dressed, A Century of Hollywood Costume Design. We are delighted to have her here in studio. Deborah, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's really interesting because before an actor opens his or her mouth, there's a story to be told based on whatever wardrobe he or she appears on screen in.
Exactly. Well, it's the old thing about a picture tells a thousand words. It's a tool a filmmaker has to tell the story, and we all do it. We all do it in our daily life. Every time we wake up in the morning, we decide what we're going to wear. And what we're going to wear is going to be based on what the weather is outside, where we're going, whether we're going to the market, whether we're going to school, whether we're going to church. And we make these same kind of decisions in films. And every costume designer starts with a screenplay. So you can imagine if a screenplay was given to a director like Tim Burton, it's going to look one way. If it's given to Steven Spielberg, it's going to look another way. If it's given to Martin Scorsese, it's going to look a third way, the same exact screenplay. So a costume designer works with this film director and tries to understand what the vision is. And the director has to be the supreme communicator. What is the vision for the screenplay? Then we start to develop these characters from the script. And just in the same way that everyone listening to this program makes choices about their clothes and the clothes that they're wearing now, that's the role of the costume designer. The costume designer has to choose for these characters, using the same criteria, what they would be wearing in any scene. So it's much, much more than glamour. It's how to tell the story without words by simply creating these characters.
Do you create your own backstory based on what you've read in the screenplay, or do you ask the director and the actor to furnish you with that?
Literally, the director has to tell us where the character sits in a family, if they're the middle child, if they are the extrovert or the introvert of a family, where they went to high school, were they the big man on campus, were they shy and retiring, how much money they make. We have to know everything about a character, the socioeconomic rules and regulations of the character. We have to know everything. We have to know if it's Dallas or New York or somewhere in between. So it's the director who really is the interpreter of this screenplay.
You have, though, a uniquely intimate working relationship with both the director and the actor. It would seem, to a greater extent than almost anybody else who's on the set, you're really working closely with
both of them. That's exactly right. No, it's exactly right, but people often think it's the actor who's in the driver's seat. That's quite wrong. Actors are supposed to transform, and they use the costume as a channel for this transformation. And so no matter who it is, that character stays the same. And I'll use one of my own movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark, as an example. Indiana Jones was supposed to be Tom Selleck. Tom Selleck is 6'5" and a real massive hunk with a fabulous smile. And at the last minute, we lost him. Now, the costume was the same. I had designed and made that leather jacket and the brown fedora and the complete costume for this hunk, this 6'5" hunk. We lost him. We were without an actor. George Lucas, who was the producer, said to Steven Spielberg, what about Han Solo? He's out of a job. And Chris, what happened was this: we had Harrison Ford overnight. I remade the costume. And he wore the costume, and he became Indiana Jones and brought all of his reticence and intellectualism and all of his own personality to that role. But what I'm trying to say is that really actors are supposed to transform into these characters and to completely change. If you were to do a, if you were going to try to mimic Meryl Streep, you couldn't do it because you would have to mimic one of the characters she has been in her career. And that's the ultimate acting. So it's really the director. The director says, this is who I think it should be. We start working together. We start talking about who the character is. Then the actor comes in, could be anybody. The actor comes in, and then the costume designer gives the essence of that to the actor. And the actor uses that costume to become someone else.
Sort of a funny story about Harrison Ford. You did not costume him in Blade Runner, but in fact you had an impact on how that character looked.
Well, that's exactly right, because Ridley Scott, the director, said, I want you to wear a hat. It's a 50s film noir. And Harrison said, I'll wear anything, but I won't wear a hat, because I've been wearing a hat for 6 months and I refuse to wear a hat in another movie.
Famous last words, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
It must be a remarkable moment when you've sort of got a costume pulled together, maybe you've tried several different things, and then you see an actor step out and they see themselves, and that light comes on.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I had a story told to me by Anne Roth, who just designed Julie and Julia, or Julia and Julie, and works with Meryl Streep all the time. And she said that she and Meryl are in the fitting room, and they wait for the third person to arrive. And the third person is the character. And Meryl gets those cues from the costumes. And the other thing that Anne told me, which I think is really sensational, she said that Meryl doesn't look at herself straight on in the mirror. She kind of gives herself these sidelong glances as she's dressing and trying things on, to see what's working, almost as if willing herself to disappear into someone else.
Do you find that some actors utilize their costumes more effectively than others?
I think some actors are more willing to let it go, to let themselves go, to let themselves be ugly. And in fact, there's something tonight that I'm going to do. I had a suspicion that in order to win the Oscar for Best Actress, you'd had to look ugly in a movie, right? So I went back and I did the research, and I'm really sad to say that in order to win the Oscar for Best Actress, you look really, really bad in the movie and great on the red carpet, and you can really see the transformation. And I think that if someone's really invested in their acting, they'll go the distance and they'll do whatever it is, whether it is to be super glamorous or super bad, to make the role work.
Sometimes your job, after months of painstakingly pulling things together and creating them, is to ensure that the costumes are not even really noticed by anybody.
Well, that's really true in all contemporary films. And going back to your last question, which was so very interesting, about really becoming another character, you can imagine that if you're in something that everyone perceives as a costume, you do it in Halloween or in Mardi Gras.
Yeah, you don't like the word costume.
Because it's so superficial. It's like you, just like at the clothes in the morning, when you go to black tie and you put on that really uncomfortable underwear. Those really, you know, the Spanx with the
they're strap, good for what they're good for.
Yeah,
but
the strapless bra, and you're pulling and tugging, and you're really uncomfortable, and you're wearing your hair in a new way, and you feel very uncomfortable but very excited also. And you go out for black tie. You know, that's kind of a costume, because you're becoming somebody else for that one evening. Well, that's changing an appearance. But what if you were an actor and your role was just to work at a Walmart? That would be a little more difficult, because you would still be looking at yourself, and you wouldn't be in an 18th century Marie Antoinette dress, and you wouldn't be in a 19th century dress. You wouldn't be like the Tudor sisters. You would just be in naturalistic clothes. Those are the most difficult roles to accept as an actor, because you really have to be somebody else or in contemporary clothes. And that's really tough. It's tough because it's not acknowledged by the public, certainly, and not acknowledged sometimes by producers, directors, and sometimes not acknowledged by the actors, that somehow for today, for these 3 months, the role is you work at Walmart. That doesn't mean you're going to be wearing those Prada shoes, and you're not going to be wearing that Dolce & Gabbana jean jacket. You really have to dress appropriately for the actor. And if I can connect the dots for you a little bit further, and I certainly hope I'm being cogent about this because it's the essence of costume design, is that if your audience really goes to Walmart and knows what everybody looks like, if everybody looks more or less the same, or if you notice somebody who really stood out in that store, and someone's wearing a Sex and the City outfit, you know, something really couture shopping, the audience would be pulled out of the moment.
It's not authentic suddenly.
Not authentic, and worse than not authentic, the public and the audience and we lose our suspension of disbelief. It can sabotage a movie quicker than anything else. The moment when you turn to a friend and say, where did she, on her salary, where did she make the money to buy those shoes? Where did she get that handbag? Why is she dressed like this? It pulls you out of the moment. And that sabotages the movie. And you know what? That's the worst thing that can happen to a filmmaker. Because what we want you to do is we want you to love the movie, not the costumes.
I was surprised to read several of the designers that you quote in the book actually said it's easier in some ways to do a period show because nobody really knows how close you're getting to reality and nobody really cares. They're sort of going to give you a pass on this.
That's exactly right, because everybody knows. Everybody in this building, everybody outside, if you're all dressed up in some crazy Marie Antoinette big wig, big dress movie, says, oh, yeah, that's costumes. Ooh, how pretty. But if it's us in the studio right now and the choices we made this morning to get dressed to come, of course, it is radio, so nobody can see what we're wearing.
We both look great.
We look so good. yeah, that's a great top. When you're standing on a set and you're working on a contemporary film or a modern film and everyone's girlfriend or everyone's wife, or everyone standing there and saying, I would never in a million years wear that top, or that looks so bad, or comments. And the actors are trying to be other people. They're not themselves. That's huge. That's why they get paid so much for what they do, because they have to transform themselves, and they want to. They should want to be hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the length of their career.
Deborah Landis is my guest. She is a costume designer and David C. Copley Chair for the Study of Costume Design at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. Her book is called Dressed, A Century of Hollywood Costume Design.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. Costume designer Deborah Landis is in town to speak at the Dallas Museum of Arts, Arts and Letters Live. Her book is called Dressed, A Century of Hollywood Costume Design. Something else that's very interesting about what you do is that although you are working in a two-dimensional medium, you really have to look at three dimensions of every costume that you put together.
Yeah, that's very true. But unlike fashion, fashion designers have to make things that look good in person. And costume designers only have to make things look good projected.
So as long as we believe something, then
that's
it's okay.
Exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, it doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to look expensive on screen. And you know how, expensive clothes are made of beautiful fabric and feel good. But our costumes just have to look like they feel good. So it's really a theatrical art.
Is there psychology involved as well in sort of talking an actor into wearing something that he or she isn't not physically comfortable in, but sort of comfortable professionally in and isn't convinced works for the character?
Very much so. But just I think the word is trust more than psychology. And that, again, is no different than going to the hairdresser every single time. And you put your head in the hands of somebody and you just say, please don't screw up, you know. And I think that actors, because they're really turning into these other people and because it's their name on the line. And because if they're bad or the movie is bad, no one's going to blame the costume designer. They're going to say, oh, the actor was terrible. Of course, there's a tremendous amount of trust involved. Also, you see them naked.
You know someone very well by the time you're done.
You know their measurements. There's no hiding from a costume designer. And all of the flaws that all of us, you included, I'm sure, Chris, hide, whether you have, and I'm not saying you do, but if you have wide ankles or if you have knobby knees or if you walk a little funny or if you have a short neck, a long neck, whatever, none of us are perfect. And a costume designer helps hide all of that just the way we hide all of it. So not only does the actor have to trust us where the character is concerned, but we also have to deal with all of the vicissitudes of somebody's body and making them look good or not so good or whatever the role requires. The director does a lot of that work too, you know. The director should be telling the same thing to the actor about the character that he tells the costume designer. So we should all be on the same page once we get in the fitting room. And the actor should know where we're going. And of course, we provide actors with a lot of different choices. And ultimately, they have to be comfortable. So it's not a tug of war. The actor is the one who's accomplishing this incredible feat of a transformation. The actor is the chameleon. We're just there as facilitators.
You know, at the top of the hour, Deborah, you talked about the fact that a film would look different if it was developed by directed by Martin Scorsese as opposed to Tim Burton or someone
else.
Exactly. What's really fascinating to me about what you do is that it is clearly an art, and yet in a lot of ways you have to make all these choices and all these judgments and be very creative, but you have to sublimate your own taste to the project because this is something collaborative.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's completely true. And not only sublimate your own taste, because each director has, well, they have a way of working, if not a look. I mean, Tim Burton, I guess, is now a goth director. And when we see his new Alice in Wonderland, it's going to look very goth and be very, very dark. So it's sublimating your look, but it's also, I think it's even more profound than that, because remember, in the course of a costume designer's career, we can go from a modern comedy to a sci-fi thriller to, if they only made a Western.
They'll come back one of these
days. They'll come back, but into a Western, and then into some kind of Elizabethan thing, right? And then back into a modern drama. So we never know what our next script will be. So we have to be comfortable in all genre.
We're speaking this hour with costume designer Deborah Landis. Let's go to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. When my daughter was 14, I gave her an antique Singer sewing machine, and it didn't take long before she turned her bedroom into a sweatshop. She loves the anime costumes, and she took that love of costuming, and she's now studying theater arts at North Texas, University of North Texas in Denton. But the question we have is there a career in this? Can she earn a living? Should she become a librarian and become an archivist of costumes somewhere and work in theater on the side? Or is there a way, a route to follow to actually get a job in this?
The question of every parent with a child in the arts.
I know. I think she sounds like she's one of mine. I'm afraid all might be lost. I made my first costume really in the third grade, a Harlequin costume for Sharon Boonshoft. I learned how to sew on my grandmother's treadle singer. I was handy from the moment I was born. I had this profound love of history. And look, you can always do costume design. You can. There's always going to be she can do it as a hobby, true, if she loves history, and I bet she does because that's part of it too. I was never into fashion. I was always into history, always wanted to tell stories with the costumes. And my feeling is, yes, absolutely, she can work in a regional theater. Is she going to, or she can work in Hollywood movies and she can come to Hollywood and try her luck. I'm a big believer that there's always room for talent. But frankly, I think, yes, she can continue. She should get an MFA in costume design somewhere. I would encourage that. And she will be making costumes her entire life because if it's your vocation and your avocation, she must do it. As I had to do it, as I'm still doing it.
Where do you like to go for research? I would imagine that depending on the period, there are different sources that are sort of your go-to resources.
I'm a big first. I prefer to do research at the library because I'm old school, but I also do research on the web. But I want to go back to, because everybody listening knows what costumes are, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what costumes are, but I want to talk about the research of modern films. So, and I'd like to emphasize that if I was researching you, Chris, I would really want to try to get your family album and try to get your high school album and try to get your college album.
Thanks to Facebook, they're all out there now.
I know. Well, I would do all of that plus interview you, and I would want to know where you shop and more about you, and ultimately whether the character, again, is Mary Stuart or Amelia Earhart or the characters in Public Enemy. I really feel that the working process of the costume designer does not change. We want that first-person research. We want the memoirs. We want the original information. We don't want to go to a book that says 4,000 years of costume. You know, we don't want to get our information from portraits. We want to get our information from the real deal and then use our imagination.
Of course, almost everybody has something odd that they'll wear or something odd that they do with the way they carry themselves that may be part of who they are as a character, but doesn't directly relate to the story. Are you sort of limited by directors? Some of them will allow you to indulge this idea that you have, and others say, no, people are going to wonder what that's doing there.
Oh, no, not at all. You always want to have crazy things. You always want to have, listen, when Nicole Kidman was in The Hours, she said it was the handkerchief that gave her the direction. I mean, I think that you want to have specific things about what your aunt did, what your dad did. My father was a Navy man. So even though he was no longer in the Navy and no longer lived near the water, he had all the, you know, everything about my dad had an anchor on it. He wore socks. That one sock was, I guess the right sock was green and the left sock was red. And there were tip-offs to my dad that he was all Navy all the time. So, and if he was a character in a movie, even though he was nowhere near the water, this is the richness of every single one of us. And let me go a little further. Everything that you're wearing right now, and everything that I'm wearing right now, and everything that everyone who's listening to us is wearing right now, did not come from one store in one day. Everyone is wearing an accessory or a piece of clothing that's inherited, that was a gift, that has a story. You might know how much the things you're wearing cost where you bought it, if you, how long you've had it, if you've had it on sale. I've had people tell me, this is my brother's, this is my sister's, this was given to me by my grandmother. Every single thing you are wearing right now has a story, has a history. That's the best research that we can do, and that is really what costume design is all about.
Do you sort of engage in that sort of on the side at airports and places where you have an opportunity to people watch?
Absolutely. And that's really where the best research is, because costume designers take pictures wherever they go and accumulate that research. But you also have to talk to people and ask them about, tell me about your watch. Tell me about your ring. Tell me about your necklace. Tell me about your earrings. Tell me about those shoes. And you can't imagine the stories that come out. They're fantastic. And that is really when costume design, and that's why I hate that word costume, because it really goes to a totally different level. It's not shopping.
Deborah Landis is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to the Colony, where we'll speak with Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hi. Enjoying your show.
Thanks.
I heard your guest talking about like doing current contemporary pieces and dressing people in, you might say, ordinary clothes, like people you may see at Walmart. My question is, do you sew all the clothes for the costumes? Excuse me. If you wanted to make someone look like they were, you know, Walmart shopper, do you just go to Walmart and buy the clothes there?
Well, as I just said, you never buy everything all at once. In reality, you would never buy everything all at once. And no, sometimes you would create a design and create something if you couldn't find just the right thing. Jeans, we buy. But I bet you didn't know that even in a contemporary film, nothing you see on screen is new. In other words, We do buy multiple pairs of jeans, but supposed to be authentic, and if it's supposed to be a modern show, everything goes to the dry cleaners. Everything gets the term of art is distressed. Everything is aged. Everything goes into the washer dryer. You don't see anything. You're not supposed to see anything that's pressed up and looking new. And what I always say is those clothes only appear in soap operas. And that's why soap operas look the way they do. But that's also the form of the soap opera, which is slightly, which is a different kind of a structure and slightly more theatrical and stagey. But yeah, we make things. I mean, on a show like my friend Kate Adair designs Desperate Housewives. And she said that in Desperate Housewives, she will find the skirt, the right skirt, and then it's not worth her time to go out and then look for the matching blouse. So she'll make it up. And of course, she doesn't do the sewing herself. When I say make it up, I mean she will design it, and then someone in a workroom. And Hollywood, as you all should know, is very unionized, and someone in a workroom of Local 705 will sew it up for her. So, yes, in all movies are a mix of rented, purchased, and then aged and designed clothes.
There's some wonderful detail in the book about the design for Audrey Hepburn's costume as Eliza Doolittle.
Yes.
And the work that went into making it look like...
It almost fell apart.
Yeah.
Right.
Tea stains poured on things and things dyed and bleached and dyed again.
Right. As the flower girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cecil Beaton talks about the fact that it was so aged that the rags, they could hardly put it on her because it almost fell apart when they put it on her. It was so filthy.
Now, are you on set the whole time to provide maintenance for this stuff as well, or do you sort of come in to do the design and then other people take over once the film's in production?
Well, we have a big crew. I mean, it depends, and certainly movies are now either very high budget or very low budget. Movies are tending to be closer either to $10 million or $100 million because of all the special effects. But yes, we have a crew, and the crew shrinks or expands for the budget of the movie. And it's the costume designer, usually, and we're the head. We're the creative head of our department, of the costume department. And then we have an assistant designer who helps us do our thing. And then we have a costume supervisor and costumers. And in movies, costumers mean the people who work on the set, maintain the costumes, dress the actors. And they're really the hands. They are the management team. And they keep the costumes exactly as we set them. So we spend a lot of time on this on the film set, being with the actors, talking to the director, and getting ready for the next scene.
Let's go next on the phone to Phil in Plano. Hello, Phil.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking our call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thanks.
I had a question. Do you have to be part engineer as well as, you know, costume designer when you're dealing with special effects and hiding squids and stuff like that for action or science fiction?
That's a good question. I've had a lot of experience with squids. What everybody does is we sit around and we do a line-by-line read-through. So we sit around a very big conference table, and everyone's there from stunts to special effects. And you can imagine that in a movie like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Vic Armstrong was the stunt coordinator, and he's still a huge stunt coordinator. And so I had to make costumes that would accommodate him, all the rigging. You can imagine being pulled off the truck, and nothing has changed vis-a-vis practical stunts in 100 years. We use fire retardants. The stunt people are padded, so all the costumes have to be made considerably bigger. And then we do have to talk to the stunt people and special effects people about blue screen, green screen, and matting out certain things for special effects. But we do that all in that line-by-line read-through.
Deborah Landis is with us. Her book is called Dressed, A Century of Hollywood Costume Design. She is in town to speak tonight at the DMA for the Arts and Letters Live Series. You can get on the line to join us by calling 800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is costume designer Deborah Landis. We'll go back now to speak with Stephen in Dallas. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Have one comment that was inspired by what I was hearing while I was on hold, and then a couple of quick questions. The comment about costuming versus wardrobing, and there's a thought experiment that I like to use. I do a little bit of costume design for local theaters. What happens if you wake up completely naked? What have you lost? What have you missed? If you ask the average person to inventory everything that they had, you know, everything from car keys to wallet to glasses to everything that they had, and you kind of begin to see why this is a much broader topic than just the clothes that you're wearing. And that's kind of when I have a trouble getting somebody to understand that the costume, really, you do need a lot of detail to put one together. Two questions that I have.
You know, just give us one, Stephen, because we got a lot of people on the line.
Oh, sure. Are there any, is the term wardrobe malfunction a real thing, or are we just being snowjobbed?
Oh, well, I really don't know what happened, but I think it's a fantastic term that I had never heard before that happened. And I couldn't weigh in on whether it was planned or not planned. But no, I had never used the word wardrobe malfunction. And in fact, in the movie business, we're trying to get rid of the word wardrobe. And now we say a wardrobe is a piece of furniture. We are the costume department. Please don't use the word wardrobe. So we're trying to raise the prestige and status of what is essentially has been considered women's work in Hollywood for all these many years.
Well, it's interesting, and we sort of see the arc in the book of how it has sort of waxed and waned over the years. First, there were these big studio costume departments, and then the studio system went away, and suddenly there was no sort of chief of design.
Yes, well, actually it started before then. When movies began, it was a catch-as-catch-can. Actors were actually hired if they had the clothes. I think that was the story of Mary Pickford, that she had a hat that the director admired and said, I'll give you $5 extra if you wear that hat. You got the job. So when movies started, it was very much whatever. And then in the early 20s, when the film studios became factories, they established these costume departments. And of course, why did they establish costume departments? Because they didn't want their actors and actresses going off the studio lot because it took too much time, and time is money, to find the costumes. So they established a costume department on the lot, just like they established a hairdresser and a barber and a studio restaurant on the lot, so that nobody would go off the lot to go eat. It was just a money-saving kind of thing. And now we're back to reinventing the wheel, where a costume designer has to establish their own shop and wherever they are. And many, 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 if not most movies, are not made in Hollywood anymore. I mean, Hollywood movies are made where states are reimbursing, are giving tax rebates to producers. So now there's a lot of production in Detroit. And we know there's a ton of production in New Orleans, a lot of production in Toronto. So these Hollywood costume designers are actually designing these costumes all over the country, setting up shops all over the country. And it's very much the way it was at the very beginning of the movie business. It's gone full circle.
You can't know, I suppose you might have a sense that a movie you're working on is going to be this big thing, but you don't know for sure.
You never know.
You, though, designed the jacket that Michael Jackson wore in Thriller that everybody knows is mm-hmm. the red with the zippers and everything. And then just a few weeks later, knockoffs were being made and they were sold everywhere.
Yes.
What happened to you on that? Do you have any right to that design?
No. We are work for hire. And keep in mind that no one knows, and not even Steven Spielberg, no one knows if a film is going to be a hit or a flop. I designed 1941 for Steven Spielberg, and it came out in, I guess, 1979, and it was a huge flop. And then Steven called me when I was designing the Blues Brothers in Chicago, and he called and he said, look, I'm going to do a low-budget B picture, Raiders of the Lost Ark. What do you think? And I said, sure, we'll be an A team on a B picture, and the movie is iconic. When we worked on Thriller, my husband John Landis said, okay, well, Michael called and he would like us to make a mini movie, not a music video, but a mini movie. And Thriller had already gone double platinum. The album was a huge hit. So we made this movie, a mini movie, and we did it exactly like a movie. And Rick Baker, who is a fantastic 8-Oscar'd makeup man, did the makeup. And I did my job exactly the way I do it on any film. I read the script. I did some designs. I spoke to John. I spoke to Michael. Michael was recording his next album. I went to his recording studio in the middle of the night, which is when he wanted to see me. In fact, I had two young children, so I slept on the sofa in the receptionist's office with my portfolio waiting for him to get me. And then at 1 o'clock in the morning, I went in, and then I went home and went to sleep. But we had no idea that it would become so iconic. And in terms of the red leather jacket, I designed it in the only way I knew how. I knew that he would be dancing in front of ghouls. I know the whole set would be filled with fog. that it would all, the palette would be gray and black. And I wanted Michael to pop at the head of this dancing pyramid. And really, all great design is reductive and quite specific. And when you think about it, was I going to put Michael in white? I don't think so. In black, you'd never would have seen him. And then red seems to make so much sense, doesn't it? So, I mean, I just came to that design the way I would come to any design for any movie. And then it's out of my control. And in terms of, in terms of residuals, costume designers don't get them. In terms of iconic costumes, costume designers don't get any remittances. You can't, we get paid for the day. And the last money I saw in Thriller was the last day I worked making it. Same thing true of Indiana Jones. Same thing true of those Ray-Ban Wayfarers. Those Ray-Ban Wayfarers for the Blues Brothers. They weren't making them anymore. Ray-Ban had discontinued the Wayfarer. And so I had to find them on Rounders. I found them in Watts. I found them in Harlem. I picked up 12 pair for John Belushi and 12 pair for Dan Aykroyd, put them on. And then the next year, Tom Cruise wore them in Risky Business. And suddenly Ray-Ban was calling me and they were back in business with a Wayfarer. But these movies could have been flops, and then we would be without Wayfarers. We would be without a red leather jacket. And if a movie is a flop, nobody wants the costume. The costume doesn't become iconic. The icons are created by the public. And if the public embraces something and no one ever knows what the public is going to embrace, that's what makes an icon.
Does it gall you, though, to walk into Party City? And literally all the films you just mentioned can be purchased in GR
form. Yes, yes. And in fact, you know, it does gall me because I really feel like even with no money, I'd love to have my name on it. You know, I'd love to have the pride of the creative pride of having my name be on something, you know, but it's just not to be. Costume designers are invisible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Deborah Landis. We will go next to Philip in Fort Worth. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I just had a quick question. Both my girlfriend and I, and also my brother, who's an editor, we all work in the industry, kind of. And, you know, my question is, I'm a cinematographer, and my question was more on to your collaboration process with the on-set director of photography and kind of determining, you know, different lighting techniques for different scenes, maybe. What sort of palette he was going for more, so if there is much dialogue between you and the director of photography on set, or if it just varies by type of stylistic film in which you're creating.
Well, as you know very, very well, it all comes from the director. Director first. The director has that same conversation with the cinematographer and the production designer, by the way. And I always think of a film set as a wagon wheel with the director in the center and we're the creative spokes. And the director's saying the same thing to everyone. Now, we do work very closely with a cinematographer because there are two parts of costume design. The first part I really have spoken about at length, which is that we serve the story, we serve the narrative. And the second part is the B part, which is the composition of the frame. So is it a bright room? Is it a dark room? And of course, costume designers, just like cinematographers, want to test everything. If you have a film test and you look at the lighting with the costume, with the hair and makeup, then you don't have to do it on the day. And you save money, you save aggravation, the actor feels more comfortable, you can tell whether something's going to be matte or something's going to be shiny and what to improve, and you don't have to wait until dailies or rushes and it's too late. So in answer to your question, composition is so important, but we really want to test, and a conversation or many conversations with the cinematographer is so important. And I want to make one more point about costume design. Movies are about people, and costumes will always be in the foreground action. And the actor, the director will never call action until the actor is in the center of the frame, because unless you're in a documentary or you're interested in the scenery, the movie is going to be about that person, and the costumes are going to be right there.
How do you sort of get over when a film that you're really proud of in terms of what you've created doesn't do well commercially? Do you care? Can you say to yourself, well, I'm really pleased with what I did and let it go?
That's how you have to be with everything. I've had extraordinary luck. I've been on such wonderful movies. I mean, look at Coming to America. I don't think Coming to America is ever off television. It just seems to always be on television. It is the Christmas movie in England, Coming to America.
Sort of the Cinderella story done with African characters.
That's exactly right. That movie was made in 1988, right? So I've been incredibly lucky. But anyone who moves, who works in the movie business, we just have to do our job. We do, and we all do, 100% of the time we work. It's such a hard job. It's so not glamorous. The hours are so long. We really work hard to make every movie great. But that's not in our control. And the public really, the public decides at the end. So when a movie breaks out of the box and becomes a Raiders or becomes a Thriller or even a Coming to America or Trading Places or Blues Brothers or Animal House, it is a surprise. It's more a surprise when they're a hit than when they're a flop. We keep our expectations low so we're never disappointed.
Do you, when you watch another designer's work, do you have to sort of force yourself to put that out of your head when you take on your next project?
Of course, like any specialist. Sure, I'm an artist, and I'm always looking at costumes, and like any veteran, what I like the best is when I don't notice them, mm-hmm. when I'm just so in the movie.
So it's still possible for you to get into the movie.
Yeah, but you know that's why people who work in the film industry, when we're in the movie and we give it up and we cry, when we laugh and we would cry, that's the best. That's the sweetest. That's what we want. We want to be in the movie. We want to let it go. We want to go on the ride. We paid for our ticket and we want to go on the ride.
Deborah Landis is an Academy Award nominated costume designer and David C. Copley Chair for the Study of Costume Design at UCLA. Her book is called Dressed, A Century of Hollywood Costume Design, and she'll be speaking tonight at 7 at Arts and Letters Live. You can learn about that at DallasMuseumOfArt.org. Deborah, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.